Good afternoon and welcome everyone to the NIEHS-sponsored seminar on TCE, PCBs, and phthalates, exposure mechanisms of disease and cleanup remedies. This webinar highlights research that is underway at the NIEHS Superfund Research Program Centers at Northeastern University and the University of Kentucky. My name is Heather Henry. I'm a program administrator with the Superfund Research Program at NIEHS, and today I will be your moderator. While we wait for others to join, I'll go over a few housekeeping items before we get started. When you registered, you were directed to this seminar's specific URL, which is the front page of today's webinar. The front page of the webcast contains a presentation overview and pictures of short bio sketches of the presenters. Please note the presenters' emails are hotlinked in that page so that you can, if you have any questions, you can go back and ask. You can go back and ask them directly. A majority of our participants will be listening to the presentation audio online through Adobe Connect. If you have problems with this audio, please check your own PC speakers or headphones. For those of you joining us via the limited number of phone lines, you may need to turn off your computer speakers or the online audio to eliminate duplicate broadcasts. So if you're hearing an echo, that might be this might pertain to you. So your phone lines were automatically put on mute when you joined the call. We request that you keep your phone on mute for the seminar to reduce background noise. But during the question and answer session, you will be welcome to take your phone off mute and ask a question by pressing #6 and taking your phone back onto mute by pressing *6. So if you want to jot that down, #6 takes your phone off mute and *6 puts your phone back onto mute. Also, please do not put us on hold. Many organizations have hold music or advertisements that can be very disruptive on the call. So by now, you should be joined into the Adobe Connect meeting room, and you should see a number of windows, or as we call them in the business, we call them pods, and these are going to have different presentation materials for you. You can see the main seminar slides on your left. In addition, there's a related URLs link in the middle. And I just wanted to point out that within that related URLs links, we do have links that will open to a website that will give you a higher level of detail about each of these two centers, Northeastern and University of Kentucky. And we thought if you want, you might want to open up those links because those links have a lot more detail about each of the projects and cores that you'll be hearing about, whereas today's webinar is really meant to be a conversation starter just to introduce a broad audience about the promising research that will be coming out of these centers. So if you experience technical issues with Adobe Connect, you can download the slide that will be covered in the seminar homepage and then follow along manually. You may submit questions by using the Q&A pod that you see in the lower right corner. You do not need to wait until the Q&A periods to submit your questions. In fact, we encourage you to submit in advance of the Q&A session. Please add who the question is directed to. That helps us know about the timing and the specific context of your question. Also, please note that questions will only be visible to the host. Other participants will not be able to view your questions. At the appropriate time for the Q&A, I will read the questions out loud to be answered by the presenters. And we will do every effort we can to get through all of the questions. We generally try to ask them in the order that they were received. But if for some reason we don't get to some questions today, we will certainly follow up later on after the webinar. If you experience technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use the Q&A pod to alert us to the technical difficulties you're encountering. Please include a phone number. If you're having those issues and you use the Q&A pod, please include your phone number where you can be reached and we can contact you to help sort out those problems. You may need to contact our technical support directly at the number, which is at the bottom of the slide. That number is 301-589-5318. With that, we're ready again to start the session. And once more, I would like to remind phone participants to keep your phones off mute. And again, please do not put us on hold. So one of the things that we wanted to do first in starting out this webinar was give you a little idea about the Superfund research program and its mandates. We're funded under the Superfund Amendment Reauthorization Act, which is also known as SARA legislation, and we have four primary mandates, one for health, human health assessment, one for risk assessment, one for detection technologies in the environment, and lastly, one for reducing the amount and toxicity of hazardous substances in the environment. And we, through various funding mechanisms, were able to accomplish those goals. Today we're going to be focusing on the multi-project centers, which is integrated centers that include biomedical science, environmental science and engineering, as well as community engagement, research translation, and training activities. We do have a number of other open and some closed solicitations, and we've provided the link there so that you can access more information about our funding opportunities. And we did want to show you an idea of the breadth and distribution of the grants that we have. About 16 Superfund multi-project centers. We have 8 individual research projects on biochemical interactions. We have a number of small business innovative research programs throughout the United States. I think we are currently funding about 10. We have an open solicitation for an occupational safety and training grant program. And we have a number, in addition to our actual grantees, we have a number of collaborating institutions who are working with them, as well as a number of sites and outreach activities throughout the nation. And so I am really, it's great honor that we're able to talk about today's presentations by the PROTECT team at Northeastern, as well as the University of Kentucky Superfund Research Center. And again, we have links to the actual project pages so that you can follow along for more detail. But today, what we are hoping to accomplish is to let the greater, let a big audience from the CLUIN audience learn a little bit more about these programs, find out about areas of interest to this, and contact the investigators if there are any questions or if you are particularly interested in their research. So without further ado, thank you, that's the right slide we wanted to go to. So first we're going to hear from the scientists at the Northeastern University SRP Center, the Puerto Rico Test Site for Exploring Contamination Threats, or PROTECT. PROTECT brings together researchers from multiple disciplines to study the transport, exposure, health impact, and remediation of contaminants, particularly TCE and phthalates. Center researchers are particularly focused on Superfund sites that are found in the northwestern part of Puerto Rico and are looking in particular at the high preterm birth rates, seeing if there's a connection between the two. So we will hear from our Northeastern Superfund Center Director, Akram Alshawebka, Deputy Director and Human Subjects Sampling Corps Leader, Jose Cordero, and Project Leader, Ingrid Padilla. So, Akram, I will pass it to you now.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you, Heather, and good afternoon, everyone. First, I'd like to thank the Superfund Research Program and the EPA CLUIN team for giving us this opportunity to present the work of the PROTECT Center. It's really a wonderful opportunity to start also the conversation and give an update about our progress with the larger community. Is it good, Heather?
Yes, your sound is perfect. Thank you.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you. So what we will do is I will briefly give an overview of the center and our approach, and then Jose Cordero and Ingrid Padilla will present a summary of the project and the course, and end with an acknowledgement. Jose will talk about the biomedical projects and course, and then Ingrid will talk about the environmental projects and the data core. Just a brief background. Our center started officially in 2010. Our work started way before then, around 2007, when we started the conversation with Jose and the team to build the center. and the planning for it. What is special about our center, something we always would like to emphasize, is that it involves many institutions and partners. So we are the lead at Northeastern University. We also work with the University of Puerto Rico, the two campuses, the engineering campus at Mayagüez, that's where Ingrid is, and the medical school in San Juan, and also the University of Michigan. We also collaborate, we have collaborators and colleagues from West Virginia University, Silent Spring Institute, and Earthsoft, Inc., and really it's a significant collaboration that we needed to be able to achieve the work that we're targeting. Our colleagues joining us from different locations. So we have Ingrid actually will be presenting from Mayagüez in Puerto Rico, and Jose will be presenting from Athens, Georgia. Our approach is more trying to look into contamination from source to outcome. And to be able to do that, it requires multidisciplinary expertise in engineering, environmental health, and biomedical sciences. So we have really a very diverse expertise at multiple, many locations in around the U.S., Puerto Rico. These are the key aspects or the unique aspects of our center. The primary health outcome that we look at is preterm birth. We focus on the Superfund sites in northern Puerto Rico to understand exposure and health outcome and then develop knowledge that will allow us to translate this knowledge to hydrogeology. We'll talk briefly about that. And then our main focus is chlorinated solvents, specifically TCE. These are TCE is present as a non-aqueous phase liquid and other chlorinated solvents same way. In the subsurface, they could be dissolved in the groundwater, or they also could be present as vapors in the unsaturated zone. Because they are present as NAPLs, their slow dissolution and limited biodegradability make for a long-term presence and difficulty in cleaning up. It's a major problem around the U.S., and many of the sites in Puerto Rico have these chlorinated solvents and TCE. Phthalates, widely used in consumer and personal care products, they also result in widespread environmental contamination and human exposure. They are also present in a diverse products and applications, which makes the exposure to different kind of phthalates, and these vary from depending on the source of exposure. Now, these two groups of chemicals, phthalates and chlorinated solvents, have been associated with preterm birth and adverse reproductive outcomes, as well as other health impacts, and they're present in Puerto Rico and the U.S. What I'll do first is talk about preterm birth. Sorry to move the slide over here. Preterm birth, babies born before 37 weeks of completed gestation are considered preterm. Puerto Rico has one of the highest rates in the world when it comes to preterm birth. Now, I have a couple of different numbers in the chart over here. Puerto Rico, it shows at 6.9%, and below in the text, it shows at 7.7%. And the one in the chart, that's for 2013. The one in the text was 2012, and I did not get a chance to fix that. But the point here, too, is actually when we started in 2007, the rate was close to 20%. And, you know, about one in five live births is preterm in Puerto Rico, which was high. And over the past few years, it was fortunately decreasing to around these current rates. And I think in 2014, there was also a reduction in the rate. So that was great news. So the impact of preterm birth are significant. It is the leading term complications. So really reducing preterm birth is important for Puerto Rico as well as the U.S. It will also not only help save babies, but also minimize the escalating costs of health care. In the U.S., the cost of preterm birth is about $26 billion. That was in 2005 numbers, and that does not include the costs of medical care beyond the early childhood or total cost of special education and lost productivity. So we continue to see that the causes of preterm birth remain largely unexplained, and the environmental exposure is a factor. So that's where our project comes in play over here. Why Puerto Rico? It's especially the North Coast is affected by a long history of toxic spills and chemical waste that were released into the subsurface, and many of those were from industries like the pharmaceutical and chemical companies that have operated there because of significant tax breaks. That led to a lot of contamination, hundreds of waste sites. 16 of them are currently active on the national priority list of Superfund sites, and there are 22 historical sites. Of course, some of these sites are deleted because of because of completed remediation. The challenge with Puerto Rico is also, I have to look at my watch, make sure I'm on time. The challenge in Puerto Rico is the geology. This is the limestone aquifers, highly permeable karst aquifers. They're different than the typical sandy or alluvial aquifers. So these are aquifers. I have a few pictures over here to show. Those are in geologic settings that are predominated by dissolution of soluble rocks such as limestone and dolomite. So they have exposure pathways through the presence of fissures, sinkholes, and underground streams. And those usually make these aquifers highly productive, but when we talk about contamination, presence, and distribution, dissolution, it's a big problem because we lose the filtration effect that is typically present in the sand, and then the flow rates are high and slow depending on where they are and what coming from, so where they're coming from, so that makes of the exposure variable and a little bit more complicated to work with. The karst aquifers are not specific to Puerto Rico. There are many of these in the U.S. Actually, about 40% of groundwater used for drinking comes from karst aquifers in the U.S. Many areas around the world have karst formations and have aquifers that are karst. There are some studies on the hydrology of these aquifers, but there's limited knowledge when it comes to how the contaminants are stored, move, and how people are exposed to contaminants from these aquifers. So that's where our research comes in play. That's where our center is. We try to understand how much environmental contamination contributes to preterm birth in Puerto Rico, and that will lead us also to translate that knowledge to the U.S. How significant is exposure to contaminated groundwater in karst regions? We focus in Puerto Rico, but we also look at other regions, try to translate that to other regions. And, of course, we would like to develop technologies for detection and remediation so when we minimize exposure to contamination from these sites. So our center consists of 5 projects. 3 are biomedical. Those are the ones that Jose will talk about, and 2 environmental. Ingrid will talk about those. We have 2 research support cores that are really central to our approach. One is the human subject and sampling, and the other one is the data management and modeling core. And we have 4 enrichment cores for admin, research translation, training, and community engagement, significant to maintain the coherence of the center and translate beyond just the research. Project 1 is an AP project. Project 2 is a mechanistic project. 3 is non-targeted analysis study, and 4 is faith and transport. 5 is remediation. 4 and 5 are the environmental. I also show a chart showing how we look at contamination from source to outcome, and Project 4 looks into the source, faith and transport, and how that leads to exposure. Project 5 does the remediation. Projects 1, 2, and 3 look into exposure, mechanisms, and outcome, all that integrated within a centralized approach where the human subject core collect all the samples, data, environmental samples, as well as biomedical samples from the participants that we recruit, and then distribute that samples and data and historical records to the project, and then everything gets integrated into a centralized data core that brings the science and knowledge from these complex disciplines, the different disciplines, to allow us to do these together. This is the team. I want to give a picture, and I think we have also pictures of them in the project, so I won't mention much over here other than, again, the team is multidisciplinary and present in different locations in the U.S., but we work together very closely. And I will then move to Jose right now, who is in Athens, Georgia, and we'll talk about the human subject core and the biomedical project. Jose?
Thank you, Akram. Let me try again.
Okay.
Okay, can you hear me better now?
Still, why don't you keep talking, and we'll give you feedback in a minute. Just
okay. Yeah, I'm using my headphones.
I would recommend you don't use your headphones if that's possible.
No, excuse me. No, not the headphone. I'm using the regular phone. That's right.
Okay, it may be switched to speaker.
Let me try that.
Thank you.
If there's a cell phone close by, that may have an impact.
Okay, let me take that away. All right, can you hear me better now?
That's good. Thank you.
Well, that's better. I was using. Okay, let me start again.
Did you turn off the other phone because the audio is still poor quality?
I'm so sorry. I think I don't have other phones. I just have the. Okay. Just a second. I think what you mean.
We can hear you. It's just that your audio quality is breaking up.
I'm so sorry. I'm using my. Hey, can you hear me better?
It's not. I'm afraid it's not much of an improvement. I wonder if we could switch to Ingrid and maybe have you on a different line.
Okay, I'm going to try that. Let's do that.
Okay, Ingrid, are you available? Can we skip ahead to your slides?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. So this is going up there. Sorry. So this is Ingrid Padilla. Hi. I'll be briefly talking about the environmental projects in PROTECT, namely Project 4 and 5. It says 3 and 4, but it's 4 and 5. And I'll be talking about some of the supporting cores as well. So I am the lead. Actually, I need to move my own. I am the lead for Project 4, which studies the transport and exposure pathways of contaminants in cars' groundwater systems. As Akram mentioned before, and I just want to recapitulate on that because it's so important, these systems are very productive, and they are important resources of fresh water for human consumption and ecological integrity. They actually provide about 20 to 25% of the global water needs and supply about 40% of the drinking water in the U.S., just like Akram said. As a matter of fact, our fellow presenters from University of Kentucky, similar to Puerto Rico, are in CARS regions. So 100% of our groups are in CARS regions, not that 20% that it's supposed to be. So the same characteristics that make CARS aquifers highly productive make them highly vulnerable to contamination. Indeed, our work has shown that about a quarter of the Superfund sites in the United States are in CARS regions. However, they're so complex to understand that it's very difficult to predict the contaminant mobility, their persistence, and their pathways. So given these challenges, Project 4 aims at characterizing the fate and transport of contaminants in CARS groundwater systems. We are doing this at the laboratory and at the field scale with our field work focusing on the CARS region of northern Puerto Rico. We're also assessing the spatial and temporal variability of water quality in groundwater sources as well as tap water point of use and studying the effect of external and internal factors on the contaminant distribution in CARS systems. But ultimately, what Project 4 aims to is developing technologies that will allow us to better predict and reduce the potential exposure of contaminants in CARS systems. So our regional field analysis in the northern CARS region of Puerto Rico has found extensive contamination, as you could see in this graph or figures, both spatially and temporally. For chlorinated volatile organic compounds, what we call CVOCs, the contamination extends way beyond the demarc zones of contamination sources. So if this is the contamination sources, you're seeing it spread all over the area. There's several contamination areas, but we know that they're extending way beyond those areas. We also see that the Karst groundwater aquifers have shown contamination for a long period of time spanning from the early 1980s. Well, that's actually when they were placed in the national priority list, but the contamination has to be there since before that. For phthalates, so this is for chlorinated volatile organic compounds, we do look at more than just TCE. We looked at a number of CVOCs, including the TCE and PCE, carbon tetrachloroform, chloroform, and other chlorinated volatile organics. For phthalates, there's much less data than for CVOCs, which makes a challenge to analyze. But the analysis shows a significant association of the detection frequencies and concentrations with physical and hydraulic characteristics of the karst aquifers, particularly the aquifer permeabilities and the sinkhole density where the phthalates could enter the system. Our results also show significant differences in the detection frequencies and concentrations between the source water, namely groundwater, and the tap water point of view. You could see for CVOCs, for instance, that the detection, about 77% of the sites, it's much higher in groundwater than in tap water, which is we detect in about 58% of the sites. We see that there is a difference between the types of CVOCs that are detected more frequently in groundwater than tap water, or then you don't see it here, but there is a difference. For phthalates, on the other hand, detection is much higher for tap water sources, having a detection of 54% over the groundwater with a detection of 24%, still significant in both cases. And we also find that DEHP, it's actually the phthalate contaminant that is found in both types of waters. Project 4, it's also conducting experimental work at the laboratory scale, so that we could characterize and quantify the transport regions and parameters in karst groundwater media. But we are now starting to move toward conducting experimental work at the watershed scales, which they're smaller than the regional scale you've seen for the northern karst of Puerto Rico, just the data that I showed you before, but it's larger than the lab scale where we're studying the fundamental processes. So this work will allow us to translate what we learned from the lab scale studies into what is actually happening at the field scale, or this is what we're trying to do. In the next, I'm going to be talking about Project 5. Project 5, it also integrates lab work and the fundamental processes at the laboratory scale and applies them to the field scale. So both environmental projects are looking into the fundamentals of phaeton transfer process at Northeastern University. It's developing a novel environmentally friendly groundwater remediation technology that uses solar-powered electrolysis to regulate water redox transformations of contaminants to non-toxic forms. The project focuses on transformation of chlorinated solvents such as trichloroethane, TCE, but the process is designed to treat other types and mixtures of contaminants in water. The project also evaluates the transformation pathways and their associated effects on water toxicity. And as I mentioned before, Project 5 is also engineering the operational system for field implementation of the remediation system. So solar-powered electrolysis is attained by applying current through electrons in an electrolyte solution. Two specific transformation mechanisms are being evaluated in PROTECT. Under chemical oxidation on the left, iron 2 and a catalyst are used to electrochemically generate hydrogen peroxide and oxygen, which oxidize organics and their intermediates. The under electrochemical reduction, or the processes that you see on the right, iron anodes reduce an environment that leads to reductive dechlorination of aqueous TCE and other chlorinated ethenes. Either processes can be adopted depending on the target conditions and what we want to attain. The Project 5, the technology developed, has proven to transform all dissolved TCE from groundwater as well as to simultaneously transform contaminant mixtures. this is broken in here. The development of this technology has led to a patent application for the novel 2-electrode remediation system, as well as many publications, as you see on the right. And it's moving forward with the implementation of the field pilot testing. Now, the task of integrating all of the biomedical, epidemiologic, demographic, xenobiotic, and environmental data that you'll hear from Jose into a centralized repository, it's amazingly well done by the Data Management and Monitoring Core led by Dr. Dave Kelly. I'm not going to say much about the Data Core, as a recent Kluin presentation given by Dr. Kelly on this subject is available for access on the web, and I'll be giving this link at the end of the presentation. But in summary, the Data Core collects, cleans, and effectively manages all the data collected, which is like millions of records, as you will see, and provides the support for the development of user interfaces for data entry, analysis, and visualization. I don't really want to get into all these numbers because we'll be here for a long time, but I just wanted to give you a sense of the amount of data managed by the Data Core, which at the moment it's in the millions of records and the billions of data points. This is really, really big, and it's amazing the work that they're doing. Another core that serves as an anchor for multidisciplinary interactions in PROTECT is the Community Engagement Core, or the CEC. This core is led by Dr. Carmen Vélez Vega at the University of Puerto Rico Medical Campus and Dr. Phil Brown at Northeastern University. And the CEC provides the bi-directional and ethical communication to engage researchers, community members, and other stakeholders in the issues concerning environmental contamination, public health, and environmental justice. The CEC, although it's, you know, relatively addition to PROTECT, it was not here in the first phase, it's just joined us in the last year or so, has been extremely active and successful in engaging communities and other stakeholders. And this has led to winning the 2015 People's Choice Award at the EPA Community Involvement Training Conference and establishing several very strong partnerships, including the March of Dimes and other community-based organizations. So this is the part of the environmental projects and the core that I was going to talk about. Jose, are you available to talk now? And then we'll get to the end.
Jose, you may need to hit #6 to take yourself off mute.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, you sound great.
Okay, perfect. I was trying to mention earlier, I will be describing the biomedical projects and how they weave on the human subject and sampling core that connects most of them. So I'll start by describing the human sampling core, the study area, the process, and then we'll describe the findings of the projects. The core it developed the infrastructure to, just a second, to change the slides. So the core developed the infrastructure to recruit pregnant women early gestation, all less than 16 weeks, and follow them to the completion of their pregnancy. The follow-up consists of sequential structure interviews, collection, biological samples, as well as environmental samples, such as getting water from the kitchen faucet in their homes. The core also processes, archives, and distributes collected samples to project investigators, and it is part of that millions of data points that the data core collects and maintains, and it's used both for all the projects. The study part that is depicted in the map, it includes a large aquifer, which is the key source of drinking water in the island. And all the points that you see represent national priority list sites and other recognized and documented contaminated sites. And as I mentioned, Puerto Rico has a high density of contaminated sites and probably one of the highest when you look at it from sites per square mile compared to other U.S. jurisdictions. how do we conduct the follow-up and what we do at each step? First, we start with screening, and that's done at the very first prenatal visit. And that generally happens between 9 to 12 weeks, although we recruit women up to 20 weeks gestation. Of course, and then we have a visit that actually starts 16 to 20 weeks, a second visit 20 to 24, and another at 24 to 28. Plus that delivery and postpartum, we also follow up. Visit 1 and visit 3 are very similar in terms that includes an interview, medical records abstraction, biological samples that include both blood. We, again, a geographical coordinate for the side of the house. Also, we did this in conjunction with Ingrid's group, and water samples are collected too, as well as a urine and hair sample from the mother. On the visit 3, in addition to all the other things we described, we also can do a food frequency questionnaire. For some of the we have been recruiting in 6 different sites, and they're shown in the map, both the clinics that we recruit, but also the hospital sites. And we've screened over 1,345 have our live birth, that we had 38 that had other outcomes. That's it, early loss, pregnancy losses, or stillbirth. We have had also some important progress in addressing withdrawal rates. The very first year, it was a little bit high, about 32%, and now we are about 11% participate. But then there's spouse or partner said, not really, I'm not sure we want to do that. So we changed the process to ensure that both the couple were in agreement with participants. Investigates exposure to phthalates during pregnancy, identify connections between environmental chemicals and markers, but also it's looking at how can what we learned can be translated into prevention in the PROTECT cohort. And the levels for some of them are elevated, much higher than what you see in sort of the distribution in normal in women of reproductive age and the NHANES. And CDC lab has been doing those tests for us. Also, we found strong and positive relations with multiple kinds of phthalates and markers of oxidative stress. Here are some examples of that, where drinking and cooking with water from private wells was associated with a higher metabolites of phthalates, although it was not significant because of a small sample size. But also there were some products like use of perfume and color cosmetics and nail polish that actually were associated with increased phthalate levels. And here we list three different other circumstances, plastic cistern use for water storage, microwaving, and also ice cream, or chicken consumption. That's also a very interesting finding. Project 2 is addressing toxic inactivation of pathways in preterm birth. And the work, I think, that it can be described better in the next slide, and is that looking at the impact that both phthalates and TCEs have, both in terms of reactive oxygen species and leading to inflammation, release of prostaglandins, et cetera, but also what happens when you combine or look at the interaction of infection, in this case, group B strep. And here are some of the specific findings. Let me just move to the next one that also describes it very well in terms of the actual experiment. Rita La Caruso found in her group is that the TCE metabolite inhibits TNF-alpha production, which is quite important for tissue defense against infection. And in the second in vitro model, and that is shown in the little inset that has a little pink color, but in essence, exposure to to phthalates increases and the production of prostaglandins in macrophages, placenta macrophages. Again, a direct line showing the how phthalates actually may create a pathway for dealings to basically looking at what's the profile of exposures that pregnant women have, whether they have preterm birth or normal birth. And it is one project that links closely both biomedical and engineering. He developed this wonderful system to basically collect the products from the urine, and we call them it's just like a tea bag, but actually it allows to collect and concentrate the collection of different paddle. The other thing that Roger has been doing is develop a new way of a mass stack for ultrasensitive detection, especially in sulfates. And with that, he improved or increased the detection by nearly 75 folds. And here you have an example of the some of the results. One of the important things is several, and essentially you get the same profile. Also, it shows in that higher detection for especially sulfate molecules. So that again, it's an important role.
I'll just go with the just making sure we acknowledge that are involved in the center, many universities within the Protect the SRP program, and many of our partners. And we also have a slide in case there are questions, and a link also to a previous call-in. And please feel free to reach out to us. You have our emails in the introduction slide and in the call-in link, as well as feel free to reach us through the phone number and email over here. Thank you.
Thank you, Akram. Thank you, Jose and Ingrid, and thank you smoothly. So at this time, we are open for questions, and there are some folks who are on the phone and others who are listening via online, and there is a little question box. It looks like a speech bubble, and you click, you ask your question in there. You hopefully will say to whom your question is directed. And then when you press the little speech bubble, it will show up, and we here in the studio can ask that question on your behalf. Take your phone off mute, which means pressing #6. So we have a question here online. Let's start with our online. And after that, I'm going to give a chance for phone line participants. We have a question from Dr. Schreiber. Robert Schreiber, asking if Jose Cordero, he says, did Jose Cordero indicate that there is no linkage statistically between drinking water and phthalates that could cause preterm birth and increase preterm birth rates?
Is the question whether there is a link between drinking water and phthalates?
The question was whether you had indicated a linkage, a statistic linkage between drinking water and phthalates that could cause preterm birth rates.
No, I have not. I did not say that. Simply, we are at the early stage and of the collecting data, so all we can actually describe is that the levels of phthalates in women of reproductive age that are participants in the study tend to be higher than those in the NHANES. And that's all I think that we were trying to indicate.
Great. Thank you for clarifying that. In the interest of time, we'll give those of us on the, those who are on the, and not hearing from anyone out there. I think in the interest of time, we will go ahead and move on to our University of Kentucky program. However, we encourage people to continue to submit your questions because we will go over questions at the end of the webinar. questions that pertain both to the University of Kentucky and the Northeastern program.
If I may, just we had one last slide I wanted to show if we had time, which we have two conferences would like to make sure people are interested. One is the Superfund Annual Conference, will be held in San Juan in Puerto Rico in November, and the other one is the KARST, Groundwater Contamination and Public Health Conference in January in San Juan, and the links are over there, and the links are also at our website in the PROTECT. Thank you.
UK slides. University of Kentucky slides. I'll give a brief introduction to the type of research that they're working on. So they're working on chlorinated contaminants again, in particular PCBs and PCEs. And the UK Center is advancing our understanding of toxicant-induced mechanisms of disease, including atherosclerosis, postnatal complications, and diabetes. They also have some sustainable approaches for PCB and TCE remediation. So we will hear from the center director, Dr. Bernard Hennig, as well as his two doctoral trainees who are at the University of Kentucky, Michael Petrello and Angela Gutierrez. And since they are trainees, we'll make sure to ask them really hard questions at the end, right, Bernie?
Yeah, this is Bernie Hennig. Can you
hi,
hear
Bernie.
Me all?
Yeah, we can hear you. Thanks.
Perfect. thank you, Heather, for this introduction. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about the University of Kentucky Superfund Research Center. Our presentation is divided into three main sections. First, I will give some background about our center's approach to mitigating environmental health risks. Then I will turn the floor over to two of our trainees. Providing unique training opportunities for graduate students and postdocs, such as participating in a national webinar like this one, is an important part of our center's mission. Dr. Michael Petrillo, a postdoctoral scholar working in my lab, will discuss how we quantify health risks associated with exposure to Superfund pollutants and how we investigate ways to improve health for exposed populations by advocating positive lifestyle changes, including healthful nutrition and increased physical activity or exercise. And then Angela Gutierrez, a graduate student working on engineering solutions, will discuss our center's environmental sensing and remediation research. She will end with a summary of how we translate our research to broad audiences and engage with our stakeholders.
Excuse me, Dr. Hennig, there's been a request that if you could please speak a little bit louder.
Okay.
Thank you.
Our center focuses primarily on two main toxicants, polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs, and trichloroethylene, or TCE. PCBs and TCE are prevalent at Superfund sites across the nation and are considered some of the chemicals of greatest concern in terms of adverse health effects and difficulty of remediation. Our focus on PCBs and TCE is specific to the challenges that we face in Kentucky, where these chemicals are detected at Saduca Gaseous Diffusion Plant, which is over 3,000 acres in size. Our Superfund Research Center uses this site to provide context for our laboratory research, technology transfer efforts, and our methods for engaging with communities. We have been collaborating with governmental, industry, and community stakeholders at this site for many years. And later in our presentation, we will discuss how the knowledge we have gained by working at this site has influenced our research and resulted in cutting-edge technology discoveries and full-scale engineering technologies. Our research has also been influenced by the significant health issues that Kentucky faces. While obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, hypertension, and cancer are national challenges, Kentucky community faces. As a land-grant institution, the University of Kentucky is committed to improve people's lives through excellence in education, research, and service. This commitment frames the work we do within our Superfund Research Center. Without our center, and as you can see in this slide, we consider how healthful nutrition or an increased consumption of fruits and vegetables that are rich in antioxidant and anti-inflammatory nutrients or bioactive compounds may provide a platform to develop primary prevention or intervention strategies for diseases associated with environmental toxic insults. This also provides the basis for new risk assessment paradigms. Recognizing that reducing disease risks associated with exposures to environmental pollutants requires multi-level and interdisciplinary strategies that include both the biomedical and environmental science fields, as seen in this overview slide, we work and collaborate with individuals inside and also outside of our university sites can markedly influence mechanisms of toxicity of chlorinated organics and other pollutants and possibly reduce our vulnerability to environmental insults. We also consider ways in which green engineering technologies that include bioactive nutrients can be used to identify and reduce environmental exposures. Our ultimate goal is to discover new perspectives, technologies, and approaches for decreasing environmental health risks. I now would like to introduce Dr. Michael Petrillo. Mike joined our Superfund Research Center as a doctoral student and is now a postdoctoral trainee engaged within both our biomedical and environmental sciences projects. Mike very much enjoys the transdisciplinary nature of the Superfund Research Program, and I consider him a very important and valuable member of our UK Superfund family.
Thanks for the introduction. I've been working with the UK Superfund Research Center for about 5 years now, and I'm excited to have the opportunity today to talk about some of the current experts in the fields of nutrition, diabetes, perinatal effects, and big data. As a team, we're all interested in preventing pollutant-induced chronic inflammation by using sensible lifestyle modifications, such as making healthy eating choices and decreasing sedentary habits. To accomplish these large center-wide goals, we utilize a state-of-the-art research support core that's led by Dr. Andrew Morris and Arnie Stromberg. Dr. Morris and his team provides critical instrumentation and analytical support for not only our biomedical projects, but also for the environmental science projects you'll hear about from Angela in a little bit. Dr. Stromberg provides an in-house one-stop shop for all of our biostatistical needs and is available at all stages of the research process from study design throughout data communication. As a center, we're very interested in advancing and translating our basic science to have more of a clinical focus moving forward. One way we're attempting to do this is to put a strong emphasis on identifying human biomarkers of nutrition and pollutant exposure. For example, we're currently collaborating with researchers here at UK who work closely with Eastern Appalachian populations. It's known that these populations are at high risk for many chronic diseases, but little is known if exposures to environmental pollutants or interactions between nutrition and pollutants play a role in disease outcomes in these areas. We've shown previously in the lab that some dietary habits may exacerbate toxicant-induced inflammation, and some habits may actually decrease the toxicity of environmental pollutants. But now, with the capabilities of our research support core, we can start to examine these paradigms in human populations. As we collect larger and larger data sets, our center is equipped to unravel significant interactions between biomarkers of nutrients and pollutants, which may help explain why certain individuals may be more or less susceptible to pollutant-induced disease. So now I'd like to briefly outline our three biomedical projects, starting with the project I've been working on, which is led by Drs. Bernie Hennig and Dr. Andrew Morris. We focus on links between nutrition, environmental pollution, and heart disease, although inflammation and cardiovascular disease. As Dr. Hennig pointed out earlier, Kentucky is a leader in many negative health statistics that we're not too proud of. Chronic inflammatory disorders, such as heart disease and diabetes, are highly present, and susceptibility to these diseases is even higher in Appalachian regions, which is made up of populations facing severe poverty and poor nutrition. As we continue leveraging our collaborations within UK and beyond, we're now continue leveraging our collaborations to become more aware that these populations are also exposed to environmental pollutants. In the lab, we work primarily on polychlorinated biphenyl-induced inflammation and heart disease. We traditionally have focused on the most toxic type of PCBs, known as coplanar PCBs, like PCB 77, 126, 169, but we've recently begun investigating toxic synergistic effects of real-world PCB mixtures. Now that we have the analytical capabilities to determine true body burdens of susceptible populations, in the future, we can tailor our lab-based toxicity analyses to more closely mirror what people in our state are actually exposed to. As I mentioned earlier, such as those found in fruits and vegetables, may prevent the pro-inflammatory effects of PCBs. Most recently, we've published a study where we fed mice a diet supplemented with polyphenols found in green tea. We determined that mice fed this anti-inflammatory diet were protected from PCB toxicity. What was really interesting about this study was that these green tea-fed mice exhibited strong... We know that a lot of environmental stressors exert their toxicity by inducing chronic inflammation. It makes sense that diets high in anti-inflammatory compounds may buffer the body against toxic insult. Our second biomedical project is led by Dr. Kevin Pearson and Holly Swanson and focuses on early life exposures and developmental origins of disease. Kevin is investigating if maternal exercise during pregnancy may be an effective means of protecting exposed offspring from the toxic effects of pollutants. A growing body of evidence now shows that the 9 months you spend in utero may beneficially or negatively shape the rest of your life. Environmental pollutants such as PCBs are highly lipophilic, and epidemiological-based studies now correlate maternal levels of PCBs with offspring effects such as gender-specific obesity. So this is an overview of the general study design that is focused on identifying the effects of maternal PCB exposure on offspring obesity, glucose intolerance, and diabetes. Dr. Pearson's working hypothesis is that offspring of exposed mothers may be predisposed to adult obesity and diets, and epigenetics is really interesting and deserves more attention in the future. Dr. Pearson's group uses primarily mouse models to examine perinatal effects of PCBs, and these generational studies take a long time to complete. Observations published in a recent paper revealed that offspring exposed perinatally to PCBs had significantly worse fat and lean mass profiles compared to offspring born to control-treated moms. Further, mature offspring born to PCB-exposed moms had impaired glucose tolerance compared to homeostasis in the offspring. Pregnancy is a sensitive period when environmental pollutants could have a significant and long-lasting effect on offspring health. Exercise may effectively mitigate the environmental health impacts of PCB exposure and could prove effective in ameliorating the detrimental health outcomes. Our final biomedical health project is led by Dr. Lisa Cassis and is focused against the negative effects of PCBs and related pollutants using anti-inflammatory methods. As Dr. Hennig mentioned earlier, diabetes is reaching epidemic levels in the U.S. Type 2 diabetes makes up nearly 95% of all diabetes incidences and has multiple risk factors, but it's really important to quickly discuss so you can understand Dr. Cassis's experimental design and models. PCBs and other dioxin-like pollutants can enter cells and bind a signaling molecule called the aryl hydrocarbon receptor. This AHR protein is found in most cell types, including cells that make up blood vessels and actually lead to chronic inflammation and associated diseases. Dr. Cassis is investigating the role AHR activation plays in PCB-induced diabetes using primarily mouse models. To accomplish this, her team has created a novel mouse model that lacks AHR only in fat cells. Observation has led them to investigate bioactive nutrients that are known to alter AHR, such as phytochemicals found in grapes. So in summary, many environmental pollutants are stored in fat tissues, which may chronically cause adipose inflammation, but may exert even wider-ranging problems if large amounts are emptied into the bloodstream. It may be advantageous to develop sensible therapies to prevent the overall negative effects of environmental pollutants during times of rapid weight loss. And brought with her a love of salsa dancing and comic books. And she did bring an interest in designing new technologies to better capture PCBs for real-world remediation. Angela?
Thanks, Mike, for the introduction. As we all know, environmental contamination is a big concern, not only here in Kentucky and throughout the which was what motivated me most to come to the University of Kentucky. I have been working with the University of Kentucky Superfund Research Center for about 3 years now, and I am excited to have the opportunity today to talk about some of the current progress and future goals of our two environmental science projects, as well as how we are communicating and transferring our lab-based science to lots of different communities and stakeholders. Our environmental science projects are led by these six individuals who are experts in the fields of pollutant remediation, nanoparticles, and big data. As a team, we are all interested in preventing pollutant-induced disease by using sensible and cost-effective green technologies to clean up the environment from a wide variety of contaminants. Focus on developing techniques that can easily and rapidly capture and detect PCBs at the part per billion levels. Just like Mike and his biomedical colleagues, we use nutrients found in healthy fruits and vegetables to better sense and remediate environmental pollutants. We have shown that plant-based polyphenols have a strong affinity for contaminants, such as PCBs, and we can take advantage of this to create new materials that are effective remediation options. PCBs pose multiple health risks, and common remediation techniques are typically disruptive to the environment, costly, and more important, unsustainable. Additionally, there are only a few techniques that can easily and rapidly detect PCB species at the part per billion levels needed for useful screening. To address sensing, capture and release, or capture, sense, and release. Our nanoparticles are magnetic, which allows for easy handling and material regeneration through a thermal process, ultimately creating a sustainable, environmentally friendly system. Currently, we have been working on developing and characterizing the polyphenol-coated nanoparticle binding studies to determine affinity coefficient using mathematical models as seen on the graph on your screen. We are currently working to effectively tune our polyphenol-coated nanoparticle systems so we have strong PCB binding, but still the ability to magnetically decant the contaminants. For example, we have been working on similarly, we are interested in using polyphenol-based technologies to sense the presence of PCBs in environmental samples. Polyphenols and related compounds have specific absorption and emission patterns, or spectra, that can change in response to interactions with contaminants. So far, we have screened a variety of fluorescent probes, including polyphenols, for changes in fluorescent properties when these probes interact with PCB molecules. Our data suggests that fluorescent-based interactions are a viable platform for sensing environmental pollutants. So in summary, sensing and remediation of pollutants using nutrients found in healthy diets. In my ongoing work, we focus on sensing and capture of environmental pollutants. Our second environmental science project goes a step further and is working on degrading these pollutants using membrane-based technologies. This work is under the leaderships of Dr. D.B. Bhattacharya and Lyndall Ormsby. The overall goal of this project is to better understand chloro-organic degradation processes and develop cost-effective, sustainable technologies in over 50% of U.S. groundwater. And current remediation technologies are ineffective in completely degrading toxic chemicals from water sources. Current technologies are high in cost, lack effectiveness, and may pose risks to those installing or utilizing the technology. As Dr. Hennig mentioned earlier, with DB, we work to develop processes for creating functionalized membranes for complete degradation and remediation. We are using both reductive and oxidative strategies in concert to effectively dechlorinate and degrade PCBs and TCE. Much like my work, DB also uses iron-based nanoparticles in his membranes, but his technology is very unique because they have successfully immobilized the nanoparticles by synthesizing them inside the membrane pores. This helps prevent our leaching into the environment and limit any fear of secondary environmental impacts. We have also joined forces with manufacturing. It requires the backing of a company for manufacturing. Shown here is a filter module, which much like the one you'd use at home, but this one contains a spiral wound membrane with embedded nanoparticles that is being pursued for use for TCE dechlorination at Paducah. We are leveraging these technologies and working with several companies to do so. For instance, our collaborative work with Nanostone Membrane Company has led to scale-up of functionalized membranes with immobilized iron nanoparticles for remediation. The knowledge gained from our PCB TCE research has now allowed us to branch out and work on other environmental pollutants. PCB remediation can be applied to other areas of pollutants and trace metal contaminants. One such example is selenium, found in power plant water. Our work with iron and iron oxide functionalized nanocomposite membranes has also led to two other funding and collaborative experts. Dr. Lyndall Ormsby and Dr. Kelly Pennell are experts in the fate, transport, and treatment of contaminants, and bring extensive experience engaging with regulatory, professional, and community stakeholders. Dr. Don Brewer and Dr. Lisa Getke are both experts in nutritional science and intervention, and have long-lasting relationships with communities across the Commonwealth of Kentucky. Dr. Anna Hoover is trained as a communication scientist with emphasis on public health. She has developed community engagement models that have been implemented in real-world settings, including the Paducah gaseous. To ensure our research extends beyond our university walls, we use a multidirectional interaction model, where faculty and students develop long-term, meaningful partnerships with governmental agency staff, industry professionals, and impacted communities. Through frequent interactions with our stakeholders, we gain a deeper understanding of the issues in which they are interested. We serve as a bridge, listening and then respond to curricula for multi-lesson nutritional training programs, such as Eat Good, Feel Good, and Color Your Plate. Both of these programs emphasize how nutrition can help your body be its healthiest even when your environment is not. In addition, we also respond to specific concerns of exposed communities. As an example, we have been engaged with a super against these exposures. Our team is also committed to sharing relevant research findings with the greater community. For example, in response to policymakers who expressed interest in the role of healthful lifestyle, at a recent health fair, Dr. Brewer and trainees shared research findings about how older adults can promote their health even despite past environmental exposures. Together, they engaged with over 200 older adults. He summarized his talk in a Kentucky newspaper column entitled, Lifelong Health Begins Before Birth. We form formal and informal partnerships with different government agencies to provide science-based information that can be used in policy decisions. For example, we hold monthly seminars at the offices of our state agencies on environmental health topics identified by state agency staff. These seminars not only respond to their informational needs, but we have also found that the seminars provide a monthly opportunity to meet with state agency staff and discuss how our research can better respond to the challenges they face in risk assessment and risk management. We also engage with EPA and APSDR on a side-by-side and topic-by-topic basis. For instance, to bridge our EPA interactions within the southeastern U.S., we recently collaborated with Duke University and the University of North Carolina to establish an ongoing partnership between our Superfund research program centers. We have also developed a stakeholder engagement process that has been implemented at two sites in Kentucky. Our team also works together to ensure our lab is green, as well as through the discussion of other applications with the industry stakeholders shown here. Our biomedical projects are also involved with tech transfer by providing valuable information that is used in policy decision making. Each year, Dr. Ormsby, our center's associate director, goes to centers around the nation. Our faculty and trainees collaborate with Miami University of Ohio on a program called Fighting with Food that provides resources to high school teachers about nutrition and pollution. Throughout the various stages of the technology and knowledge transfer process, our trainees are mentored by faculty and stakeholders, so that their current and future discoveries gain societal importance and relevance.
Thank you, Angela and Mike. We appreciate this opportunity to present to you about our center's activities. As Mike and Angela have both highlighted, the University of Kentucky solutions to reduce or prevent exposures. We provide unique training experiences for our students inside and outside of the laboratory to maximize the values of their current and future discoveries to our stakeholders. The photo on the right was taken during a recent annual SRP meeting. We strive to achieve our university's land grants mission to improve people's lives within Kentucky and nationally through excellence in education, research, and creative work and service. Most of all, we work as a cohesive team within the University of Kentucky, and we actively seek opportunities to develop external collaborations with individuals holding various forms of expertise so that our research results can contribute to applicable real-world European Conference on Health and the Environment, or called CICHI. Please put this event on your calendar. As a final note, I want to thank our RTC and our trainees, and especially Brad Newsom for preparing the slides used in this webinar. We also wish to thank the audience for listening and participating in this
webinar. That was very, very interesting and very thorough overview of the research projects that the University of Kentucky group is working on. We do have some questions for the UK team specifically, and also several questions came in for the Northeastern team. So while we have the UK folks online right now, I'll go ahead and start with those questions, but I did want to alert our Northeastern folks to please be on hand, because we'll follow up with some questions to them that came through the line. The first question came from Michael, and the question is, are there cell or tissue research underway or pending that can be used in place of non-human animal models that do not necessarily translate well to humans due to differences in metabolism?
Hi, Heather.
Hi, Michael.
Can you repeat it one more time? We were just running into the conference room.
Human animal models. Where those non-human animal models don't necessarily translate well to humans because of the differences in metabolism.
Sure. Specifically with Project One, with Dr. Hennig's project, we do a lot of our work with primary porcine, so pig cells. So we isolate pig cells from the endothelium, from the blood vessel. So that's one example. But okay. As a group, we're trying to get more human relevant, so that's a focus of ours.
Great. Thank you. And this question is for Angela. With regard to both the nanotechnology as well as the PCBs, the PCB and TCE, a question came up about what worker safety provisions are there for PCBs, TCE, as well as for the nano remediation.
I'm not as much of an expert in this area, so I'll hand the mic to Dr. Deeby, and he'll be glad to answer this question.
Great, thank you.
Sure. Are you talking about as far as the ultimate implementation of the technology that we're talking about in the field, or are you talking about laboratory setting?
Let's talk about the application. We'll assume that you're following laboratory procedures for the TCE and PCE, but what field implications are there?
Okay, yeah, relative to, I guess, the field applications, as we mentioned, one of the things we're looking at is actually embedding the nanoparticles into membrane systems, which from the laboratory analysis that we've done, we don't see any leaching of the particles out of that, should eliminate that. Also, we're looking at, from our oxidative processes, one of the challenges there, if you're looking at the zero valent iron with say hydrogen peroxide, is safety issues with regard to those types of oxidizers. And one of the other things we really didn't have time to mention was developing a system that has a membrane where we embed an enzyme in it where we can add glucose to the membrane that will basically generate hydrogen peroxide in situ, so you don't have to transport that more, I guess, toxic oxidant to the site, which it's already embedded in the system, so that also potentially could reduce worker exposure. And then even in the development techniques where we can use some green chemistry in that process as well, that
including
would
green tea.
Including green tea as well, that we can use to basically fix the particles in the membranes, as opposed to using sodium borohydrate as an example.
Heather, if I may add one more line to that.
Sure.
This is synthesized inside the membrane, so not a single particle is outside anywhere.
Okay.
So that's the answer. That's a sweet and short answer.
Great. And I did get clarification from the questioner that they were specifically talking about Superfund sites. So thank you. I think that's a great answer. Let's move on. Another question came up. What are the main exposure routes, water, food, inhalation, of PCBs for humans in the Kentucky region, particularly around the Superfund sites throughout the state? So does the exposure route matter in terms of the effects? That's kind of a big picture question. I don't know who wants to take that one on, but that came from Cecilia Chen.
Hi, this is Wendell. I can kind of address some of the exposure pathways at the sites in Kentucky. Probably most of the sites have exposure, actually have PCB-laden oils that are literally dripping down from various places in the building, so that's a more, I guess, potentially direct exposure pathway, and there are workers involved in that are moving those materials out. We've had some facilities, for example, we mentioned Dehoyt, Kentucky, where we had PCBs that were actually burned, so you have another pathway of exposure there. So it can kind of vary, but I would think probably nationally most of the exposure pathways are probably from coolant systems, or you have electrical types of equipment where you may have leakages in the ground and probably that type of exposure pathway.
And does the exposure pathway matter in terms of the effect? Such as the obesity or the cardiovascular, different endpoints you're looking at?
Not really that we've seen. Basically just fed the mice PCB-laden foods or materials.
Okay, so looking at the oral exposure.
Right.
Okay. Great. Talking about oral exposure, how about the oral remedy? One question came in. With regard to the 4 to 6 cups of green tea to prevent adverse health effects from the environmental pollutants. The question was, that sounds like a lot of tea. Can consuming this much green tea have other adverse health effects, such as the amount of caffeine, not being able to absorb iron, or the effects of tannins, et cetera?
Well, this is Bernie Hennig. The answer, of course, is always moderation, but there are a lot of studies out there in humans, actually, not with PCBs, but with tea, where they found that the consumption of 4 to 6 cups of tea really reduces inflammatory diseases such as osteoporosis. And so in our animal studies, we kind of mimic this environment, and we saw significant protection against PCB media inflammation and related diseases such as atherosclerosis. Now, what is known is that it's not just, you know, tea is just one example, but it's known that when you consume whole foods rich in polyphenols, these bioactive nutrients that are found in fruits and vegetables, the positive effect is actually additive. So assuming you eat healthful foods, and as we know, some of these protective polyphenols are also found in some beverages, including red wine and juices, etc. So the combination and all of it together, I think, probably will give even more of a protection than just considering one component.
Thank you, Bernie. We also had a question. This came from Jose Cordero. He says, great presentation. He, of course, is one of the co-presenters today. Jose asks if you are partnering with volunteer organizations such as March of Dimes, OBGYNs, as part of the community.
Our Superfund project is all currently in the mouse models, but I do have a maternal fetal medicine fellow that works in my laboratory on another project where we are trying to translate some of our maternal exercise findings to humans. So we are starting to go in that direction. So I'm fairly new to the Superfund project here at UK, but hopefully in the next 3 or 4 years we will be doing those types of things.
Great. I'm sure Jose would be a good contact for you for those efforts.
I'm sorry, Heather, to interrupt. This is Dawn, and I'm on the Community Engagement Court, and as far as what we're doing, we have future plans. There's an organization specific to Kentucky called Helping Hands that involves work with first-time moms, and I guess apparently they're starting to involve the fathers as well. So that's one group we're trying to reach out to, and possibly maybe with WIC, Women, Infants, and Children.
Okay. Thank you, Dawn, for adding that. We have another tea question, whether decaf green tea provides the same result as regular green tea.
Yeah, that's what you
That's a great question.
Yeah. Hi, Heather. It's Mike. We actually used decaffeinated green tea for our mouse study.
Okay. So presumably that's a good starting point.
Talking about the resveratrol Lisa Kappa study?
Yes. Yes.
It's a purified resveratrol. I don't know if it's organic or not or GMO.
Okay, so you're working with the phyto compound itself, not necessarily extracting it from the grape.
That's correct. It was 99% pure trans-resveratrol that was chemically synthesized.
Chemically synthesized. So,
it's not purified from grape extract or grapes themselves.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. So I would, at this point, I would like to open the phone lines for those who are on the phone and would like to ask any questions able to hear you. And we'd love to hear where you're from before you state your question. And I would like to open the questions not only to the University of Kentucky, but also the Northeastern program.
Heather.
Hi.
I have a question for Northeastern people.
Great.
There. This is regarding the use of electrolysis to convert TC to ethane. And the slide shows, of course, you're making H2O to go to hydrogen gas, then using palladium to carry on the reaction. The question is, what's the form of the palladium and how many cycles you have done this? And then the last issue is that the hydrogen has a low solubility in the water. That is mass transfer is a problem.
That sounds like a good question for Akram.
Yes, and we use that as pellets, but we also are trying to coat it on the electrode so that it's not present within the solution itself. So we are developing the electrode so that these are integrated into the electrode surface and then minimize the issues of dealing with pellets and with the palladium in the solution, as well as looking at with and without palladium too.
Containing palladium inside, that might alleviate some of the problems.
I think it's really one of the good ideas that we have included some of that in our proposal, and it's some of the work that we're trying to develop to enhance the electrode performance itself. So this is one of the issues that we are trying to answer. Maybe we can discuss some collaboration on that one. I think it's, given the work you're doing, it's a good area for us to work together on that.
Okay, Akram, we'll discuss in Puerto Rico.
Okay, great.
Thank you for that question, DB. And the annual meeting for the Superfund Research Program will take place. That reference was to where our annual meeting will be taking place. So I'd like to see if there are other questions from the phone. Again, what you'll need to do is press pound and then 6, and that will take your phone off of mute. Again, pound 6 takes your phone off of mute. And after you do that, you can state your name and ask your question. All right, let's shift gears then. We did have a number of questions that came in for Northeastern that came in just after we had introduced the UK team. So let's go back and revisit those questions that came in. One was, in terms of CVOCs, are you also including 1,4-dioxane in the analysis?
Hi, this is Ingrid. No, we are not under the targeted analysis. So in the targeted analysis, we're using, we're working with TCE, PCE, DCE, I know these all look sound the same, chloroform, dichloromethane, carbon tetrachloride, but not the dioxane. But however, that may be, so it's not a targeted analysis.
Great. Anything to add on that? I don't know if Roger would like to jump in on that answer. Roger Giese, Roger. Is project leader for Project 3.
Hi, this is Roger.
Hi, Roger.
Oh, hi. Of the hits we got for the sulfates, none of them were dioxanes. And where we did a Metlin search. And the reason we went after sulfates is, you know, many toxic organics tend to be aromatic and at least partly go to sulfates. So that's why we wanted to, you know, look at that kind of a screen. But we may pick these things up. We're planning to test
targeted samples and, you know, test for 1,4-dioxane. It wouldn't exclude finding 1,4-dioxane in those teabag samplers.
Right.
Okay, great. Thank you for answering that question. Another question came in that's more health-related. Has the Northeastern Project assessed the incidence of cardiac defects among children born to mothers thought to be exposed to TCE?
Hi, this is Jose. Actually, our sample, total sample is going to be about 1,800. And that's not going to be sufficient to look at cardiac defects. One possibility is to look at the birth defect surveillance in Puerto Rico and line that up with areas where there are higher levels of TCE, but it is not part of what we have in our program.
Great. So it's possible your data will include that information, but it wasn't at least an outright specific aim of this project.
Yeah, and cardiac defects, are common, but common defects. But out of 1,800, the sample would be too small.
Okay. That makes sense. Another question: what methods are being used to detect TCE at contamination sites? And this was a question for any of the presenters.
Oh, hi, this is Ingrid, and I should know the method number. I'm going to guess but we're using EPA standard methods for the detection of all the chlorinated compounds as well as the phthalates, which is under non-volatile. I think it's either method 525, or it's a combination of, or that may be, but it's one of the EPA methods. I just don't recall what number it is.
Okay, perhaps we can get that from you and go back to the person who had asked that question. I saw that his first name was Carlos, but I didn't catch the last name.
Yeah, I'll be glad to. We have the information. I just don't have all that detail in my head.
Okay, understandably. There's a lot of methods to keep track of. We have a question for Jose. Were there any personal care products that were identified as significantly contributing to phthalate exposure in the study, such as more of the exposure, contributing much more than the exposure to water? And then I'll go ahead and ask a follow-up question is, how much did personal care products contribute to the overall phthalate exposure of the study group?
Okay, I think that probably John may want to answer that question.
Okay.
Because John, are you on the line?
John, if you're on the line, you'll need to hit #6 to unmute your phone. And we do have one more question after this from online, after which point we'll open it up again to the phone lines for anybody on the phone who has a question and would like to ask.
Heather, we may connect John with the person who asked the last question.
We can get back to this questioner.
Absolutely.
Right. And I think that clearly there was the link with the personal care products. The question is about the water, and that is what I don't recall from the analysis.
Okay. And we did have just one more comment. Again, this was related to the very first question that we asked before the UK presentation started. But there was just a suggestion for redisplaying the slide on the phthalates corresponding to the contaminant sources that appeared to be linked.
Great. I think that's a good idea. We'll look into.
Roger? I don't think we are, but Roger.
Yeah, no, we're not. I mean, if they're there, you know, we'll pick them up and untargeted, but we're not approaching them targeted.
About contaminants you never thought to look at initially, if they're a part of that non-targeted analysis, that sample collection where those contaminants might be locked in time and space, gives you a good opportunity to come back and sample later and ask mm-hmm. some of those questions further down the road. So it sounds like for now the fluorinated compounds are not being addressed, but you know they would potentially be a part of those non-targeted samples and could therefore be checked for later on, should that be necessary. We did get apologies from Dr. Meeker that they're experiencing technical difficulties. So again, we will follow up with the questions from Jennifer Wallen. We will follow up with that offline. That was the question about the personal care products and phthalates. So at this time, we've gone through our online questions, and I'm going to give presenters, or I'm going to give the phone participants an opportunity to ask questions again. If you are interested in asking a question from the phone, you can press #6, and that will unmute your phone so that you can ask questions to the Northeastern University Center and or the University of Kentucky Center. And while we wait, you should see a new Ways to Stay Connected page, which has miraculously pulled up. And with this page, we wanted to make sure everyone is aware of the Related URLs pod, which again contains the seminar resources and seminar feedback links. On the seminar resources page, we have assembled resources that apply directly to the question that came out about the phthalate and personal care products. We can add, and currently there are already lots of good resources about the Northeastern and University of Kentucky centers. So we place these in the seminar archive along with a soundtrack of the archive. So in the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. We also ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We definitely look at your comments. We're constantly trying to improve the content and the delivery mechanism, and we think that getting input from you is really helps us to have a better product. So we appreciate your input. And also want to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure that you don't miss any future webinars. Please bookmark the cluein.org website. It has lots of resources about new technologies, exciting research that's happening, and funding opportunities as well. There's an EPA cleanup tech Facebook page, There's also an EPA cleanup tech on Twitter. And then you can join the Cleanup Information Network, the CLUIN LinkedIn group. We also have SRP progress and research webinars, as well as risky learning webinars, and we have links to those specific webinar pages. And you can also follow SRP NIEHS on Twitter. So, as promised, I'll open the floor again for questions on the phone. Please don't be shy. Just press the pound and the six, and you can ask your question.
Hi, Heather. This is Ingrid.
Hi, Ingrid.
I'm going to try not to be shy. I just want to follow up on the question on the CVOC method. So we followed the EPA method 551.1. That's for extraction, followed by ECD analysis on the GC.
Okay, great. So that was the question from Carlos Ariza, and he seems to be still submitting questions, so hopefully he heard that. Do you want to say that one more time, though?
Okay, yeah. We're using EPA method 551.1 for the extraction,
okay,
followed by GC analysis and ECD.
Okay, great. And Carlos did suggest or submit another question. Have polyphenol-coated nanoparticles been successfully used to bind TCE? And that seems like it might be a question for DB and Lindell.
Hi, Heather. This is Angela.
Hi,
We have not used them to bind TCE. We're right now working just PCBs, but that can be something we'll work on later on.
Okay.
But Heather, let me clarify. When you made nanoparticles, Rima, the joint work with UC Berkeley and us, and after that, and also Dr. Bharma and EPA, we use polyphenols to make nanoparticles, okay, including green tea extract to other areas. And we found out the nanoparticles covered, polyphenols covered nanoparticles, did absorb TCE and which facilitated the reduction of TCE. So we do dechlorination of iron particles coated with polyphenols.
Okay. Great. Thank you for that answer.
Well, this is Bob.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, yes. Two things. On the 1,4-dioxane, I just wanted to mention that there's different methods, you know, and there's one that's, you know, much better than the others if the researchers aren't familiar with it. I believe it's a selective ion method. I could provide that if they're interested. I think it's readily available out there, and I would point them to the Florida Department of Environmental Protection and what they recommend. Also, that 1,4-dioxane, if you're not aware of it, tends to be a co-solvent or, you know, present with TCEA, basically trichloroethane, as well as dichloroethane, and one of the dichloroethane variants. So just be aware of that. And the 1,4-dioxane does tend to be ubiquitous, is in a lot of personal care products, as I understand it. So it can be found in very low concentrations. And it is definitely a very significant problem chemical for industry and hazardous waste sites, and it's getting a lot of attention. We would be very interested in it, and many of our colleagues are very interested in researching it quite a bit. Second thing is, I was the one that asked that question about the phthalates that Dr. Cordero was showing, and so I'd be very interested in knowing what the answer is in regard to, you know, the linkage, you know, to drinking water. It was unclear to me, and I have to admit that I didn't quite understand whether he was saying that there is a linkage that's been proven or whether there's still statistical work going on that is heading towards a demonstration of linkage or not. So with that, I'll go back on mute. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Well, Bob, if you'd like, you can send us your contact information, and we can directly get back to you. We can make sure that the Northeastern team has a chance to touch base with you about the 1,4-dioxane question, which I think is, yeah, we all agree it's an emerging contaminant, as well as the personal care products questions. I think that would be a valuable conversation.
Sure. Thank you.
And this is what these progress and progress and research webinars are all about. It's an opportunity to introduce the research that's coming out of the Superfund Research Center, let stakeholders know about the research that's coming and the promise of this research, and make early connections so that you can find out about some of these issues, things that the researchers should keep in mind, and things that the community at large, as in the audience here today, areas of interest related to your health and the environment. So with that, there are no more questions. I would like to really give a thank you on behalf of all of the Superfund Research Program. We really wanted to thank the Northeastern team and the University of Kentucky team for doing such an excellent job distilling all of the all of the research that they're doing into just a very small slide set and presenting on such a short time period. Not easy to do, and we certainly appreciate the very successful presentations that you put together. So again, thank Akram Al-Shawabka, Ingrid Padilla, and Jose Cordero from the Northeastern Program, and from the University of Kentucky Program, Bernie Hennig, Michael Petrello, and Angela Gutierrez. Again, thank you very much for taking your time and sharing your presentations with us today. So that includes today's presentation. We thank you for your participation. And at this time, we will conclude the webinar. You can contact the presenters via email with any follow-up questions. Again, their email addresses are on the seminar homepage in CLUIN, which is linked to from the webinar webpage. Again, thank you.